Thank you, Mr. Graby. Good morning, everybody. It's good to see so many people here, so many visitors and familiar faces and not so familiar faces. It's really good to see everybody. So the spring holy days are nearing, as we all know. Somebody said 7 weeks away. I didn't actually pull out my calendar to check the math, but that sounds about right. And we'll all be partaking of the Passover. And so what I thought I'd do during this message this morning is focus a little bit about the bread of life, one of the strong Passover symbols, one of the main Passover symbols that we partake of that evening. But I want to come at it from a slightly different angle, or an angle that maybe we don't think about a whole lot necessarily. We know the analogy, but I'm going to dive into it a little bit more. And that is manna. And so what I want to cover is three basic lessons that we can glean from manna and how that might help us better appreciate the symbol of the bread on the Passover. We're going to spend the bulk of our time during the message reviewing two passages. I'll get my words right, I promise. bulk of our time on two important passages, one in Exodus 16 and the other in John chapter 6. So let's dive in to this topic of manna and see what lessons we can learn with it. Turn with me to Exodus chapter 16. Exodus chapter 16, this is the first introduction of manna scripturally as far as what God had instructed the children of Israel and what it was for and why it even occurred. Exodus chapter 16, verse 1, and they, meaning the children of Israel, journeyed from Elim, and all the congregation of the children of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after they departed from the land of Egypt. So we'll get a little time context here. This is about a month after they depart from Egypt. So they'd already gone through the Red Sea and all of that, and they're going through the wilderness. This is a pretty barren place. So you imagine if you remember, when they left Egypt, they had food. They had baked some cakes, and they had goodies, if you will, snacks for the road, all of that stuff. By this time, they're pretty much out of their sustenance. I would surmise that they've pretty much run out of their food. In verse 2, then the whole congregation of children of Israel complained against Moses and Aaron. We'll come back to that word complain later. They complained against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And the children of Israel said to them, "Oh, that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the pots of meat, and when we ate bread to the full, for you have brought us out of this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." To kill the whole assembly with hunger. So the first lesson we can pull from this manna is that manna sustained life. That manna sustained life. As you see, they're hungry. And they, twice in this verse, they talk about killing. God's actually going to kill us through hunger. There was a very real fear of that, by the way. We think about times when we get hangry or hungry, right? We get a little upset because we're not fed right away. But I think in the back of all of our minds, we know that our next meal isn't really that far off. Like, we know where we can find our next meal, typically. We know how we're going to get it or what we need to do to get it. But they're in the middle of a desert wilderness with no 7-Elevens, with no Kroger's, with no Papa John's. None of that business is happening. And they're out of food. And I can speak as a parent. If my kid's hungry, what am I going to do about that? So they're complaining here, and there's something there, but they're also in a pretty desperate situation as a human. How am I going to eat? What am I going to do about this problem? I might die. My family might die. And this God brought us out and I'm going to blame him for that death. But manna is given to sustain life. Jump down to verse 31, and we'll go through most of this chapter throughout the message, but there's just pieces I want to pick up to pull on this lesson about manna sustaining life. And the house of Israel, this is verse 31 of Exodus 16, the house of Israel called its name manna, meaning what, or what is it? And it was like white coriander seed, and the taste of it was like wafers made with honey. Then Moses said, this is the thing which the Lord has commanded, fill an omer with it. Excuse me, we're going to jump down to verse 35. I got ahead of myself here. Verse 35, and the children of Israel ate manna for 40 years. So God delivers us to them for 40 years. Until they came to an inhabited land, they ate manna until they came to the border of the land of Canaan. So God gives them this food for 40 years to sustain their life, so that they know that where their next meal is going to come from, so that they know how they're going to feed their families for the next 40 years. Because at the beginning of this journey, they thought, I'm going to die. My family is going to die. But God doesn't allow them to die. He's got a plan, and he sustains them for 40 years. Turn with me to John chapter 6. John chapter 6. Manna sustains life. Now, we read, this is a big part of Israel's history, right? Their cultural history, their narrative. In John chapter 6, Jesus picks up on this, and he starts expanding the imagery, the importance of understanding why they went through that. Similarly, here in John chapter 6, the people, if you go back a couple of chapters, the people had just experienced a significant miracle with the feeding of the 5,000. So food was on the mind. Food was on the mind. Feeding people was on their minds. And it was a dramatic display of God's power and his care for his people. John chapter 6, verse 24 is where we'll pick this up. Again, continuing with this thought of manna sustaining life, John 6, 24. When the people, therefore, saw that Jesus was not there, you know what, let's pick it up in verse 22. On the following day, when the people who were standing on the other side of the sea saw that there was no other boat there except the one which his disciples had entered, remember Jesus had gone away to on the other side, and that Jesus had not entered the boat with his disciples, but his disciples had gone away alone. However, other boats came from Tiberias near the place where they ate bread after the Lord had given thanks. Verse 24. When the people therefore saw that Jesus was not there, nor his disciples, as they got into the boats, they came into Capernaum seeking Jesus. Seeking Jesus. These people are going out to gather, if you will. They're seeking him. And when they found him on the other side of the sea, they said, Rabbi, when did you come here? And Jesus answered them and said, most assuredly I say to you, you seek me, not because you saw the signs, but because you ate the loaves and were filled. Do not labor for the food which perishes, but for the food which endures to everlasting life, which the Son of Man will give you, because God the Father has set his seal on him. So Jesus begins to build this analogy deeper. He doesn't immediately talk about the manna. He says, you should labor for food that produces everlasting life. Everlasting life. This is not a terribly familiar concept, this everlasting life, at this point in the teachings and the knowledge of the broader church, if you will, the broader group of people that God's working with. And this concept of everlasting life is a little bit foreign. They know what it means to eat, to have physical life, and to survive. But this is something a little bit different, a little bit deeper. And then he goes further. Verse 28. Then they said to him, what shall we do that we may work the works of God? And Jesus answered and said to them, this is the work of God, that you believe him whom he sent. Okay, that's another layer here. Verse 30, therefore they said to him, what sign will you perform them that we may see it and believe you? What work will you do? Our fathers ate manna in the desert, as it is written. He gave them bread from heaven to eat. I think it's interesting. They bring up manna to him first. He doesn't He doesn't lead with it, but he set this whole context, because God's good at doing that, to draw this analogy out a little deeper. Verse 32, then Jesus said to them, "Most assuredly, I say to you, Moses did not give you bread from heaven, but my Father gives you the true bread from heaven. The bread of God is he who comes down from heaven and gives life to the world." There's that life again. It gives life to the world. And he was just talking about everlasting life. Verse 34. Then they said to him, "Lord, give us this bread always." And Jesus said to them, "I am the bread of life. He who comes to me shall never hunger, and he who believes in me shall never thirst. But I said to you that you have seen me, and yet do not believe me." Verse 37, "All that the Father gives me will come to me, and one who comes to me I will by no means cast out." So this is to everybody. I am the bread of life. It's to everybody. "For I have come down from heaven," just like manna, "not to do my own will, but the will of him who sent me. This is the will of the Father who sent me, that of all he has given me, I should lose nothing, but should raise it up at the last day." So he's pointing, again, taking this analogy and pushing it towards this understanding of everlasting life, of a life that does not go away if partaken of. "And this is the will of him who sent me, that everyone who sees the Son and believes in him may have everlasting life, and I will raise him up at the last day." He brings them to the point of it all, which is an everlasting existence, an everlasting life, resurrected into the God family as an immortal being. Now, it doesn't say all those details, but that's what he's pulling out here. He's taking, as so much scripturally happens, he's taking a physical example and pointing them to a spiritual fulfillment and what his aim and objective is. So the first lesson we can kind of meditate on when we consider the bread is that manna sustained life. And in the new covenant fulfillment, manna is the giving of everlasting life. It's if you partake of the bread of life, you end up with an everlasting life. Lesson number two about manna. Manna points to law. Manna points to law. I struggled with that word points. I wasn't sure if that was the right word, but I'm going to go with it today. Manna points to law. Let's go back to Exodus 16. We're only going in these two chapters here because this is there's more written about manna. I'll reference it. But these two chapters really kind of lay the basic groundwork and teaching on manna, on the bread of life. Lesson number two, manna points to law. Exodus 16, we're going to pick it up where we left off there in verse 4. Exodus 16, verse 4. "Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you.'" Bread from heaven. "And people shall go out and gather a certain quota every day, that I may test them, whether they will walk in my law or not. And it shall be on the sixth day that they shall prepare what they bring in, and it shall be twice as much as they gather daily." So he gives them these instructions on how to gather this manna, verses 4 and 5 here. Drop down to verse 13. Verse 13. Now remember, they wanted meat too, so quail comes in here. Verse 13, "So it was that quails came up at the evening and covered the camp, and in the morning the dew lay all around the camp. And when the layer of dew lifted, there on the surface of the wilderness was a small round substance as fine as frost on the ground. So when the children of Israel saw it, they said to one another, 'What is it?' For they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, 'This is the bread which the Lord has given you to eat.'" Just like in John 6, it's bread from heaven. It's given from God. This is a miracle taking place here. This is the thing which the Lord has commanded. Let every man gather it according to each one's need, one omer for each person. An omer is about 2 quarts, according to the scholars. According to the number of persons, let every man take for those who are in his tent. Then the children of Israel did so and gathered, some more, some less. So when they measured it by omers, he who gathered much had nothing left over, and he who gathered little had no lack. Every man had gathered according to each one's need. There's a distribution process here for the manna that's on the ground. There's a level of equity here. So one omer per individual. So if you have a household of 4, you're going to go gather 4 omers. But there's also appropriate equitable distribution for the number, for the amount that everybody would eat, too. I think sometimes when I read this and when we read this, we think, okay, everybody's sitting there with their jar of manna and a spoon, and we're just kind of, everybody has their own little, piece of it, their jar, and it's all the same. But if I was gathering for my family, I would gather 4 omers, and I would put them together in a pot, and we'd have 4 omers worth of manna, and then we'd take it, and by we, I mean Laura Beth, would take it and crush it, boil it, bake it, whatever we're going to do with it. And let's say you have this pie of manna cornbread in front of you, manna bread, and Owen's going to have a little smaller slice than Jude, who's going to have a little bigger slice than him, and Laura Beth's going to get a slice, and then I'm going to get the rest, right? Because I'm the father. Actually, right now, Jude is going to get most of the pie of manna. Because we would all be filled, but it's the same individual distribution. Every individual gets one. This isn't everybody brings their own like lunch pail and juice box and PBJ. This is a community effort, if you will. Numbers 11, by the way, talks more about how they actually worked with the manna, cooked it, all that kind of stuff. Okay, verse 19. Moses said, let no one leave any of it till morning. So again, he's putting these kind of rules, this law around how you, I'm even hesitant to call it law, it's like ordinances on how to take this manna in. Verse 20, notwithstanding, they did not heed Moses, but some of them left part until morning, and it bred worms and stank, and Moses was angry with them. So they gathered it every morning when every man according to his need, and when the sun became hot, it melted. So they had to go out in the morning to get it. If they gathered too much, it would stink and worms would show up on it. There's all these consequences if they don't follow the instruction here. Because why? Because what we read earlier in verse 3, in verse 4, where it says, that I may test them whether they will walk in my law or not. God is putting this before them. Verse 22. So it was on the 6th day, so this is a very important aspect here, on the 6th day that they gathered twice as much bread, 2 omers for each one, and all the rulers of the congregation came and told Moses. Then they said to them, this is what the Lord has said. Tomorrow is a Sabbath rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake what you will bake today, boil what you will boil, and lay up for yourselves all that remains to be kept until morning. So they laid it up until morning, and as Moses commanded, and it did not stink, nor were there any worms in it. And Moses said, eat that today, for your today is the Sabbath to the Lord. Today you will not find it in the field. 6 days you shall gather it, but on the 7th day, the Sabbath, there will be none. Now it happened, so this is human nature right here, right? There's going to be people that gather too much. There's going to be people that, and when I say people, us, Israel, we will do this. Now it gathered that some of the people went out on the 7th day to gather, but they found none. And the Lord said to Moses, how long do you refuse to keep my commandments and my laws? See, For the Lord has given you the Sabbath, therefore he gives you on the sixth day bread for 2 days. Let every man remain in his place, let no man go out of his place on the seventh day. So the people rested on the seventh day. A specific law around gathering manna surrounding the Sabbath. The Sabbath is an essential point here and supports this lesson about the manna pointing to law. In many ways, God reinstituted the Sabbath for this nation through manna collection. Remember, they came out of Egypt, they in many ways were obedient to God through their time in Egypt, or at least retained some of that culture, some of those lessons from their fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, Joseph. But the Sabbath was a, how am I going to get, God's thinking, how am I going to get this nation around my law, to center them on my law? And he institutes manna, and he puts in the Sabbath command within it. As a reminder to them that he himself rested with them, not only on the creation account, but also by not providing them the manna on the seventh day. He is resting, in a way. They're being led to a weekly cycle of rest and worship. And as we know, later on in this book, God encodes the Sabbath as part of the Ten Commandments, as part of the formal law of the nation, and as a foundation for holy time. All the holy days, and I'll go further to say the plan of God rests on and builds off of the Sabbath command. Leviticus 23 starts with, these are my feasts. The first one listed is the Sabbath, and then it goes to the rest of them. God's bringing them back to, you want to be in my people? You want to be my nation? Starts with this. And the way I'm going to get the Sabbath in your mind is by gathering food on the ground. This manna collection. Notably, Jesus Christ refers to himself as Lord of the Sabbath. Lord of the Sabbath. This is kind of a subject all in of itself, but it points to this lesson that's worth reflecting on, which is that manna points to law, or supports law, or whatever the word you want to use. We won't go there because we've read it already, but in John 6:29, the objective that Jesus said about the bread of life was that people would believe and begin to have faith in who Jesus is and what he is trying to accomplish. Similar to how God's objective in Exodus 16 was to get them, point them towards the law, point them towards something, an example, if you will. In John 6:35, it also, the reference there is to never hunger and never thirst. Well, you can only be filled if you go out and you gather. That's the only way to be filled. If you wanted to have food in Israel, every morning you had to go out and gather, except for the seventh day. So he who comes to me will never thirst and never hunger. So the natural question is, then are we gathering? Are we gathering? Are we going out there and getting something every day? God's pointing us towards Jesus, who is the embodiment of the law, who's the perfect representative of not only the letter of the law, but the spirit of the law. So lesson number two, manna points to law. Lesson number three, and this builds off of what I just stated here. Manna's characteristics are facets of Jesus Christ's characteristics. Manna's characteristics are facets of Jesus Christ. Exodus 16, again, we're just sticking in these two chapters. We haven't read this portion yet. Exodus 16, we're going to start in verse Okay, I misled you a little bit. We are going to read a little bit that we've already read here. Okay, we're going to go back to verse 4. The Lord said to Moses, "Behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you." Bread from heaven. Jesus, Son of God, came from heaven, dwelled on earth. I'm just going to kind of list these off quickly. These are facets about the manna that point to Christ. Now we'll jump down to verse 6. Then Moses and Aaron said to all the children of Israel, "At evening you shall know the Lord has brought you out of the land of Egypt, and in the morning you shall see the glory of the Lord, for he hears your complaints against the Lord. But what are we that you complain against us?" And Moses said, "This shall be seen when the Lord gives you meat to eat in the evening and in the morning bread to the full. For the Lord hears your complaints which you make against him. And what are we? Your complaints are not against us, but against the Lord." I want to pause here and dig into this just slightly, because I think it gives us some further context to Jesus as the one who addresses these issues that Israel is facing as a nation. So in this case, they're complaining. If you have other translations, this complaining is often translated as murmur or grumble, which is not bad. It's a fair translation. But the root of this word is rooted in two other Hebrew words, depending on how you pull it out. One means to exalt itself or to be lofty. So there's a puffed up pride going on here. I know better than God. He's going to leave us to die. Why did he do this? And then the other word, is one that means to lodge or to stay, like an extended stay. And so the idea here is this attitude, this pervasive attitude of the nation, this complaining, is like stuck in their culture. It's stuck in their mindset. It's proud and it's stuck. It's there. So this is what God is kind of dealing with these people. It's permeated the Israelite minds and hearts. Social psychologists call this a scarcity mindset. It's kind of a modern term with that. But this, as opposed to an abundant mindset, but this idea of it's just part of who they are. If one person complains, then the next person is going to complain, and they're all going to start complaining, which they did. But the objective here that God's doing with the manna is to point them to his glory, to point them towards him. If we're only complaining, if we're only grumbling, if we're only stuck in this mindset of, I know a little bit better than God, or I think my perception's a little superior to God's. If we're stuck in that mindset, we're going to miss the glory that God is trying to show us. We're going to miss it. We're going to miss what he's trying to do. And I'm speaking to myself more than anybody. So we don't want to miss that. But it's the setup that goes into, as we draw out some of these facets about manna, as to why it's so important to understand these things about Christ. Because as we're in these mindsets, as we're in these, I know better, and I'm not going to change my mind, if we're stuck in this pride, then we should consider the bread that God's trying to offer us and what he's trying to give us to help appease that mindset. Drop down to verse 23. I'm just going to pull these verses kind of out, these aspects. Bread from heaven, that's one of them. Christ came from heaven. Verse 23, then he said to them, "This is what the Lord has said, tomorrow's a Sabbath rest." We read that, the latter part of this verse. "Bake what you will bake today, boil what you will boil, and lay up for yourselves all that remains to be kept until morning." They did stuff with this manna. They beat it. They ground it. Numbers 11 brings this out. They worked it. And then they ate it. The analogy there, obviously, Jesus' body is broken for us. It is offered as a broken body for our sufferings, for our healings, for our infirmities, physical, mental, whatever they are. Verse 31, the house of Israel called its name manna and was like white coriander seed. The taste of it was like wafers made with honey. Again, the drawing out, it's white, it's pure, it's righteous, if you will. It's also unleavened, so it's sinless. And it's wafers made with honey. It tastes good. It's a sweetness. You know, behold the sweetness of the Lord. There's a lot to be gleaned from just the physical attributes, the physical nature of manna that we can learn about God. Then the last one I'll bring out just from this chapter, and Moses said to Aaron in verse 33, take a pot and put the omer of manna in it, lay it up before the Lord to be kept for your generations. As the Lord commanded Moses, so Aaron laid it up before the testimony to be kept. So they put the jar, golden jar, I think it was, and put it in the Ark of the Testimony as a memorial to remind people. And we memorialize Jesus' sacrifice every year on Passover. He lives in us as something we pull out from that. He sustains us. These are all facets about the character of Christ and about who he was. And they didn't know it at the time, but it was pointing to a greater fulfillment. So the third lesson is manna's characteristics are facets of Jesus Christ himself, or point to him. So there's more. There's a lot more to this. But I thought trying to stick within those two chapters as the basis for it might be a good start for anybody who wants to dig deeper into this topic. When Israel saw the manna, they said, what? It's a literal translation. What? Or what is it? Which is a really interesting thing to say. Like, what? What is this? Sometimes Janie will bring something over to the house and I'll say, what is that? It's usually very good. Always very good. I had to correct myself there. But that's how they responded. What is it? What? So as we reflect on the bread of life, on Jesus Christ, I wonder how many people say, what? What is, who is that? What is that? People who have no understanding of who he is. They might look at him and or read about him, see all these Christians out there, and think, what? Why? I don't understand this. But we don't have to do that. We don't have to do that. We have a deeper understanding of who he is, how he leads us, how he feeds us, and what his purpose is. We don't have to say, what? Because it all points to him. So, consider manna as you prepare for the Passover and prepare to partake of the bread of life.